Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. President Barack Obama flies to Cuba Sunday. He is embarking on a historic trip with the two nations moving to normalize relations after 55 years where they broke off ties. President Obama is the first sitting U.S. president to travel to Cuba in almost 90 years. He will cap a visit with a direct address to the Cuban people, outlining his vision for the future U.S.-Cuba relationship. Nearly 40 U.S. lawmakers and almost a dozen CEOs are joining President Obama for his trip to Cuba. The White House says 8 U.S. senators and 31 members of the House of Representatives are traveling to Cuba. Most are Democrats, but a few Republicans are also along. They include Arizona Senator Jeff Flake and South Carolina Representative Mark Sanford. You can read more details on the president's trip at voanews.com. Iran's Supreme Leader said Sunday that Washington has continued its animosity toward Tehran, despite a friendly message by President Barack Obama marking the Persian New Year. The state television broadcast Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's New Year's speech Sunday live from the northern city of Mashhad, where he said that the U.S., that from one hand, they send a New Year message, and on the other hand, they have kept economic sanctions. A mudslide on a hilly track buried 8 teenage students returning home after exams in northern Pakistan after several days of heavy rain, according to officials Sunday. A spokesman for the local disaster management authority said the incident occurred Saturday. This is VOA News. Investigators have recovered the flight recorders from the Fly Dubai airliner that crashed early Saturday in southern Russia, killing all 62 people on board. The cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder have been sent to Moscow for inspections. Authorities say the black boxes should show what happened in the moments leading up to the crash. The cause of that crash is yet unknown. A bus carrying university exchange students back from Spain's largest fireworks festival crashed on Sunday on a main highway in the northeastern part of the country, killing at least 13 passengers and injuring 34 others, according to officials. The passengers included Spaniards and foreign nationals from more than a dozen countries. The bus appeared to have hit a guardrail on a highway before cartwheeling across the road and slamming through a divider. Turkish authorities are blaming the Islamic State for Saturday's suicide bomb attack in Istanbul, which killed 4 people, including and Israeli, Iranian, and U.S. citizens. The Interior Minister says authorities identified the bomber and are searching for others believed to be involved in the attack. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish Interior Minister Efkan Ala says authorities used DNA samples to identify the suicide bomber who carried out the attack.
Bu menfur intihar saldırısını gerçekleştiren teröristin kimliği tespit edilmiştir.
The identity of the terrorist who carried out this wretched suicide attack has been determined. This person, this terrorist, is Mehmet Öztürk, born in 1992 and registered from Gaziantep province. Current findings show the terrorist has links to the Daesh terror group. The breakthrough came, according to reports, when Öztürk's father came forward to police after recognizing his son from surveillance footage of the bomber. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Yemeni officials say Shiite rebels and the internationally recognized government have agreed to begin a ceasefire for a week or two before their next round of negotiations. The officials participated in talks Sunday in Sana'a between the rebels and the UN envoy. They say talks are expected to restart next month. All officials spoke on condition of anonymity. Pope Francis kicked off the Holy Week leading up to Easter by celebrating Palm Sunday with pilgrims and St. Peter's Square Sunday, while observances in Jerusalem have been overshadowed by a wave of unrest. In Rome, the Pope lamented the indifference of the people, he said, who did not want to take on the responsibility of deciding the destiny of refugees who have overwhelmed Europe. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Actually, be like a signal being sent to say that the habit or the precedent of removing immunities of former presidents does not mean very well for the country.
Zambian courts restore the legal immunity of a former leader wanted on corruption charges.
The policy direction is water for all. That's the direction we are taking as a country. And as far as I know, as I'm speaking now, we are about 89% coverage in the rural areas.
Malawi launches a two-day national water conference ahead of the upcoming World Water Day on Tuesday.
The situation this year, it's very bad. Not so many tourists coming and it's very quiet. And we hope the problem is finished and the people come to visit this holy land.
And Christians around the world celebrate Palm Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Voters in Senegal are deciding in a referendum whether to approve President Macky Sall's proposal of a constitutional amendment to reduce his term limit from 7 to 5 years. Mr. Sall becomes the first sitting African head of state to make such a move, particularly when some leaders are removing term limit to enable them to stay in office in perpetuity. Alpha Jallo is a reporter in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. He joins us live via telephone link up to give us an update about the poll. Good evening, Alpha.
Good evening, Peter.
How are you doing?
I'm great.
Well, you visited some parts of Dakar monitoring the referendum. How did people go to the polls to vote today?
Yes, the vote is going out very well, although there is turnout is very poor for the moment. I have visited one of the biggest constituencies, which is also a very strategic area, that is the on the outskirts of Dakar, that is Gejewaye and Pikin, which have about 900,000 registered voters, and it is one of the biggest constituencies in Dakar. This place is so strategic because the brother of the president, Macky Sall, Aliou Sall, who is the mayor of the area, is voting here, and also a former minister of commerce, who earlier resigned from the government, Male Gakko, is also now voting here, and he has just formed a new party. So right now, people are coming to vote, but then the turnout is very poor.
Well, some civil society groups have launched campaigns sharply opposing the proposal that President Macky Sall has put in, you know, before Senegalese. How are people reacting to that?
Well, yes, a lot of them are just reacting negatively. Some of them are just saying that even the civil society and the opposition parties are just, you know, they are just saying what they want to say. But the Senegalese, especially most of the religious leaders, said that the 15 point, which is, you know, put in the proposed constitutional reforms, they said that they are very good because it will strengthen, you know, democracy and the rule of law in the country. But on the other hand, the opposition is saying that Macky Sall is using this as a scapegoat. That is, even if he finishes his 7-year term, and then if he happens to win another 5-year term, he may use the same constitutional court to allow him maybe to bid for a third term. So this is what is the, this is their worry. They are worried about this.
How long will it take the Electoral Commission to determine when the outcome of the referendum will be announced to Senegalese?
Well, you know, all elections in Senegal here, the moment the polls are closed, at 6 p.m., then results will start trickling in. So we know that, I mean, maybe the counting will start by 7 p.m., and that will go throughout the night. And I'm sure most of the important, you know, voting areas like Dakar and maybe in the countryside, we will be getting the results before daybreak. And maybe by tomorrow or maybe latest by Wednesday, they will the electoral commission will announce the official results for the referendum.
Now, Alpha, you went round talking to residents of Senegal. Why was the voter turnout low?
Yes, there is what we call, a voter apathy. Most of the people said that since President Macky Sall, has not reduced his current term of office, so it is not important for them to vote because they expected that maybe the referendum will include a clause where, his current term of office will also be part of the proposed reforms. But they said that since he is running for his seven term, it is not important. And most of the people I talked to, they say that this is a waste of state resources because right now Senegal, most of the problems are here. Most of the teachers, they are not paid. Teachers have been staging demonstrations, public health workers and all these things. They were all staging demonstrations demanding for better working conditions, etc. So most of the people I spoke to said that the referendum is not necessary. It is just a mere, waste of state resources.
Thank you very much. Alpha Diallo is a reporter in Senegal. He joined us live via telephone link up from Dakar. The Zambian courts restored the legal immunity of a former leader wanted on corruption charges. The National Assembly had stripped former President Rupia Banda of immunity so he could face criminal prosecution. Banda is officially a member of the former ruling Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, or MMD, and served as the country's fourth president from 2008 until 2011. Alexander Mutale is a journalist based in the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Viewers William Eagle asked him about the reaction to the court ruling.
Government's own reaction seems to be one of satisfaction, whereby since they entered into an agreement with the lawyers of the former president, they are comfortable with the outcome. However, civil society organizations and the opposition political parties have not come out to condemn this or to support. What we expect, however, in the next few days is that one or two of them will likely speak against because they think that the agreement was entered into for the benefit of the ruling party because the fourth Republican president, Rupia Banda, is known to be a supporter of the current government. He is not a member, but he supports them. So we expect someone to come out and actually say that it was not in the national interest, but in the interest of the ruling party.
Is this considered by some to be a one-time exceptional case, or are some concerned that it would be setting a precedent that former leaders cannot be prosecuted for corruption?
The restoration of Rupia Banda's immunity will actually be like a signal being sent to say that the habit or the precedent of removing immunities of former president does not mean very well for the country. And by saying that, I mean to say in 2002, the second Republican president, Frederick Chiluba, had his immunity lifted by the National Assembly so that he could face the corrupt charges that he was alleged to have done when he was in office. And the prosecution began, dragged on for over 5 years, but eventually was cleared of those allegations. However, his immunity was not restored until he died in 2011. Now, the difference is, even when it came to removing the immunity of the fourth president, Rupia Banda, some were concerned that it was not good to keep up the precedent that happened in the removal of the second Republican president's immunity. Some suggested that it's better to leave presidents alone who leave power, without subjecting them to prosecution. However, government went ahead. Now, what has happened is that the fact that the immunity of Rupia Banda has been restored could mean a new precedent being set of not lifting immunities of former presidents. After this, we don't expect another president to have his immunity restored because this is going to be like binding for future presidents. It would be even difficult to lift the immunity because the reason which has been given of allegations differing from charges will have to be very carefully investigated before suggesting lifting immunities of former presidents. So I think that the restoration of the president's immunity could be one way of saying, look, we are wrong to lift the immunity, just like we were wrong in the first place when we first removed the immunity of the second Republican president. Let's stop this and just leave this former president alone.
Is it expected to have any effect on the debate in the upcoming August presidential elections?
During campaigns, we expect some to say that government's decision was not right because it was not in the national interest. Many believe that the immunity or that government reached an agreement in order that the former president could support the ruling party during the next election, because it is a known fact that in 2015, in last year's snap election, to elect a successor to Michael Sata, who died in office, Rupia Banda played a very key role in ensuring that Edgar Lungu, the current president, won in the election.
Alexander Mutale is a Zambian reporter. He spoke with viewers William Eagle from Lusaka. Malawi has launched a two-day national water conference beginning Sunday to Tuesday. The objective, organizers say, seeks to find long-term measures of harnessing the relationship between water and decent work agenda for sustainable development. Dr. Alan Chiembekeza is Malawi's Minister for Agriculture, Irrigation and Water Development. He told me the country is making strides towards making water available to all citizens.
Well, this is the World Water Day. World Water Day will be celebrated on the 22nd of March. And it's a tradition within Malawi that before the day is celebrated, we have to have a conference to discuss issues about water in the country. That's basically what it is all about.
What is your government policy direction in terms of providing water to the people of Malawi? Because concerns have been raised about lack of adequate water or clean drinking water for the people. What is the policy direction on that?
Well, the policy direction is water for all. That's the direction we are taking as a country. And as far as I know, as I'm speaking now, we are about 89% coverage in the rural areas as far as water is concerned. And for the urban areas, it's over 90%. So I don't know why people are talking about issues of having no water in this country when the reports that we have read after an assessment are giving us those data.
Concerns were raised about the drought, which people said adversely affected agriculture. And they also said that recently there was the flood. They said that the government should have taken appropriate measures to resolve some of these challenges when it came to the flood, as well as when it came to the drought. What is your response to that?
Well, I don't know what you mean by appropriate measures, because nobody knows about drought. Drought just comes. I don't think there is anybody who can predict that it's going to be a drought, and this is what we should do. The same thing is about flooding. You cannot predict that this year we're going to have flooding. We do have weather data, but sometimes the data are not reliable, so it's very difficult for anybody to plan for eventualities like those. But the bottom line is, as government, we're doing a lot in that area. For dry spell, there isn't much we can do, because if it hasn't rained, it hasn't rained. But we have plenty of water in some places of this country, and we're in the process of making sure that all the water that is available is appropriately utilized for agriculture production. And for flooding, we are also planting trees, because I think that's the biggest problem that has led to the flooding. We are planting trees in all those places that are prone to flooding, and we are also advising people that live in those areas to move upland. So as government, we are really preparing for that.
What should be the expectations of Malawians after this water conference is over?
Well, like I have said, it's the World Water Day, which we celebrate every year throughout the world. And the conference that is there is actually to talk about the problems we are facing as far as water is concerned and what exactly needs to be done so that at least we meet the SDG goal of sanitation for all, sanitation and water for all, by 2030, and that's where we are gearing towards.
With this objective, sanitation, water for all by the year 2030, What is the level of progress so far, if I may ask?
Well, like I have told you, as far as water, potable water is concerned, in the rural areas, we're doing pretty well. In the urban areas, we're also doing well. The only sector that we haven't done well is the sanitation sector, and that's the area that we need to emphasize on if we are to meet the SDG for water by 2030.
Your last words for the people of Malawi as this conference takes off?
Well, my word for the people of Malawi is that they shouldn't despair. As a government, we know what problems people are facing as far as water and sanitation are concerned. So we have programs that are geared towards sorting out some of those problems. So we may have problems in terms of dry spells, but we have plans to utilize water from Lake Malawi now for drinking, especially in the areas along central region of the country. So I don't think any Malawian should worry about that. Government is working towards that.
Dr. Alan Tiembekiza is Malawi's Minister for Agriculture, Irrigation and Water Development. He spoke with me from Thiolo District in southern Malawi. Voters in Niger are choosing a president Sunday, with incumbent Mahamadou Issoufou in line to easily win the runoff after his jailed opponent was flown out of the country for medical reasons, and the opposition called for a boycott of the election. My colleague Bagasi Koura from VOA's French to Africa division joins us live via telephone link up from the Nigerian capital, Niamey. Good evening, Bagasi.
Hi, good evening.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Wonderful. How is the election going on so far in Niger?
Election is going, I can say, well. It's peaceful. It's calm. One thing is that is really noticeable is that, you know, there is not many people voting today. So the key point is that the turnout is very, very low. And we don't know if they will really reach even half of the voters today.
Now, Bagasi, you have spoken to quite a number of people as you are there on the ground. What were some of the reasons they are giving or assigning to the rather low voter turnout?
Today, most of the people who were willing to speak today are usually people supporting the president. Those are the ones going and voting. And what I heard is that Niamey is usually the stronghold of the opposition, and the opposition has called for boycott because their main champion, their candidate, Amadou, is sick and is now in France for medical reasons. Before that, he has spent 4 months in jail here. So he's not a free candidate. He has been in jail until he left the country. And because of all these reasons, the opposition has decided, with other reasons also, to not take part of this election. And they called on their militants and their partisans to stay home. And that's what they did. And I think it has been quite successful.
Now, Bagasi, wouldn't all these concerns undermine the integrity of the election? Have you been able to talk to some of the observers who have come to monitor the poll?
Yes, that's the key concern most people here have. They don't know how the turnout will look like, you know, when the polling closed, because most of the stations we went, we haven't seen a single line the whole day from 8 in the morning up to now. We haven't seen two people line up trying to vote. You know, usually we see one person voting here and there, that's it. And people are really worried, where are we going from now on? And this morning, after he voted, President Issoufou Mahamadou said that whoever wins the election, and it appears it's going to likely be him, whoever wins the election, he says, will have to reunite Nigerians so that they can face development challenges, including the fight against terrorism.
Well, it appears the work is cut out for him, since it looks like he is going to win with almost no challenger in this election.
Exactly, no challenger. What he faces is another challenge, because the turnout is quite low. It depends how low it's going to be. And if it's really low, we don't know how this country is going to look like in terms of political discussion, if people are going to try to undermine his presidency, or if some people are going to call him to organize another election another time, or if he's going to be able to escape and in the end have a very, you know, decent turnout. We don't know yet, but what we have seen so far is really low.
Have you been able to talk to some of the international poll observers there, and what has been the response of the civil society groups that are in the country, particularly with reference to how credible this election will be?
Up to now, the observer we saw, they just noticed some minor incidents because most of them try to avoid to get into, you know, national debate here, whether it was right for opposition to boycott or not, whether it was right for the president to not postpone or free his main opponent. But what they focus on is just how the day underwent, how polling stations were able to open on time or not, if people who are willing to vote were able to vote freely. That's what they have been talking about today. But I guess by the end of the day or tomorrow, when the numbers come out, maybe international observer will have some more to say.
Now, Bagasi, has the Electoral Commission signaled when they will announce the outcome of the election? Well, we know that it looks like the president is going to be reelected.
Yes, and the president of the Electoral Commission, we met him this morning after he voted. He said he has 5 days, but he was saying, you know, he gave himself and his organization 2 days, 48 hours, to give the results. And one thing to mention, since the opposition is boycotting, in almost all of the polling stations we've been, the representatives have been replaced by other people. We don't know who these are, but there is no opposition representative in polling places. And the constitution here requires both candidates to have a signature, I mean, the representative signature on the document at the end of the day. And we don't know if all this is going to bring some more contestation.
Thank you very much. Bagasi Kura is a reporter for VOA's English to Africa French Division. He spoke with me from Niamey. Christians around the world are celebrating Palm Sunday. In the Holy Land, observances have been overshadowed by a wave of unrest, as we hear from VOA's reporter in Jerusalem.
Palm Sunday dawned in Jerusalem's old city to the sound of bells at the ancient Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The holiday marks Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem 2,000 years ago and the beginning of the Christian Easter Holy Week. Priests chanted the Palm Sunday liturgy, waving olive and palm branches as fragrant incense filled the church where tradition says Jesus was crucified and rose from the dead. But it is a sparse turnout of pilgrims this year in the wake of 6 months of Israeli-Palestinian violence. Palestinian shopkeeper Abu Hassan says Holy Week usually brings crowds of tourists to the old city bazaar, but not this year.
The situation this year, it's very bad. Not so many tourists coming, and it's very quiet. And we hope the problem is finished and the people come to visit this Holy Land.
The pilgrims who made the journey were glad they did. Mark Caldwell, who came from the U.S. state of New Jersey, was fascinated by the mixture of Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the old city.
Well, it's been a lifelong dream of mine to be here, and it's an amazing nexus of three Abrahamic religions, so it's very important to me to be here, and it's an amazing historical and spiritual place.
Holy Week continues with two major events. On Good Friday, Christians will retrace the footsteps of Jesus to the 14 stations of the cross, and on Easter Sunday, they will celebrate the resurrection. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, African giants Al Ahly went through to the last 16 of the African Champions League after a 2-0 win over Recreativo Libolo of Angola in the second leg of their last 32 tie in Alexandria. Ahly, coached by former Tottenham manager Martin Joel, went into the game under some pressure after drawing the first leg in Angola goalless. Martin Joel's men eased the nerves with a strike from the impressive Ramadan Chobi after just 10 minutes, and their victory was complete in the 83rd minute when John Antwi made it 2-0. Elsewhere on Saturday, Alex McLeish watched his Zamalek side reach the last 16 with a 2-0 win over Union Douala of Cameroon in Cairo. Zamalek made the most of home advantage, having won the first leg 1-0. South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns booked their place with a 1-1 draw away to AC Leopards of Congo Brazzaville to secure a 3-1 aggregate win. Tunisian's Etoile du Sahel beat Olympique Kariba of Morocco 2-0 to advance, having drawn the first leg 1-1. Morocco did have cause to celebrate earlier in the day, as Wydad Casablanca became the first side to reach the next round of the 2016 CAF Champions League, despite a 2-1 defeat away to Synapse of Madagascar. Their 5-1 win in Morocco was enough for Wydad Casablanca to progress 6-3 on aggregate. It was an identical scoreline for Nigerian champions Enyimba, who went to Vital of Burundi with a 5-1 advantage from the first leg. Al Merrikh of Sudan beat Nigeria's Wari Wolves 1-0 to go through 2-0 on aggregate. Tanzania's Young Africans also advanced the next round after 1-1 draw with APR of Rwanda in Dar es Salaam. Young Africans were leading 2-1 from the first leg, and they held on to secure a 3-2 aggregate win. The defending champions TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo were among the teams scheduled to play on Sunday. They were set to host St. George of Ethiopia in Lubumbashi with a tie level at 2-2. Meanwhile, the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, faces a big challenge to make sure that all teams and players headed for the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio are clean. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Ben Nichols, the spokesperson for the agency, and began by asking him why it's important to curb performance-enhancing drugs in sports.
Well, I think we only have to see where we are in sport today and the reaction that we see from not only athletes across the world, the clean athletes who we represent as a body, but also the public at large. There is still a great deal of disgust and unhappiness when a doping scandal arises. And we know from our role, the athletes want a body who represents clean sport, who provides rules that ensure that cheating cannot take place and that sport is based on fair values, it's based on not artificial means to success. And I think the clearest indication that we see is when we see a doping scandal, we see the public uproar to such a scandal, and that's clear that the public still wants to see sport compete in a fair, objective manner.
When athletes train for whatever their particular sport is, they go through all kinds of physical conditioning. They do a lot of things in order to make themselves most competitive and most capable in whatever sport they happen to take part in. Now, taking the devil's advocate side, why would it be unethical or wrong if you can do weight training, if you can do this, if you can do that, if you can do all of these things for physical conditioning, why is it unethical to take substances, to take drugs, which enhance and boost whatever you're able to achieve with that physical training? Why is that wrong?
Well, it's not only unethical. I think public opinion, as I touched on already, public opinion is such that we don't accept playing sport by and winning by artificial means. We believe sport should be competed where everyone is working to their greatest extent, where they're training hard through nutrition, through diet, through hard work, not through taking banned substances and looking for an edge through artificial means. And I think we also have to take in consideration the health aspect that is key. Nowadays, there are many banned substances which are dangerous for the health, which should not be taken unless there is a medical reason, for example. And we have a duty to ensure that athletes are only taking things that they should be taking or allowed to take. So there's a health aspect, there's a spirit of sport aspect as well, if you like, and there's the performance enhancing aspect. We don't believe that society today wants performance enhancement through artificial means.
That was Ben Eco, the spokesperson for the World Anti-Doping Agency. He spoke with VOA's Jeffrey Young from Montreal. Finally, Zambian legend Kalusha Bwalya has lost his position as Football Association of Zambia president after being defeated by businessman Andrew Kamanga. Kamanga won the election against Bwalya by 163 to 156 votes in what many thought was an impossible task for the challenger. Bwalya, who was named the 1988 African Football of the Year, first joined the Football Association as vice president in 2004 before being elected president 4 years later. He served as association president for 2 terms and was gunning for a third. During his tenure as president, Zambia won the 2012 Africa Cup of Nations trophy. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Thank you. press card that he made you. See nobody, nobody replace you. So tell me, how you seen her? African queen, number one diva. Shake your pretty bum ting when I pump speaker. Don't you know we run things in a Tanzania? Oh, da 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 da. Da 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 da. Da 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 da. Da da da.
Oh, mama, you gon' make me sing.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, there were strange developments in the South African Parliament. Strange in the sense that a minor matter was elevated to the national level and from there to the international level. This phase of the matter commenced when Deputy Finance Minister alleged that he had been offered the Ministry of Finance by a prominent business family with close relationship to the President Zuma through his son. And it was a very sore point for South Africans because it refers to a troubling period few months ago when there was a debacle about the appointment of a Minister of Finance that led to the weakening of the South African currency, the rand. After that allegation by the minister, others surfaced to confirm that they too have been offered cabinet position by this prominent business family. All is well. But this is nothing new in South Africa. Rumors of this inordinate influence of the business family have been around in South Africa for 3 to 4 years. It has been in the media, it has been rumored and whispered, but never elevated. Why now? Perhaps the reason was that there were also rumors that the influence of this prominent business family was dividing the leadership of the ANC, the African National Congress. If there's anything which the media in South Africa and the opposition wanted is to find evidence of a weakening of the ANC since it won the election in 1994 under the leadership of Mr. Mandela. And because of this rumor, the leader of the opposition felt fit to raise the issue in Parliament. Last Thursday, he questioned severely President Zuma about this inordinate influence of the prominent business family. President Zuma correctly responded that he alone is one that appoints cabinet ministers, and that if the leader of opposition wanted to know what transpired with the deputy finance minister, he should go to him and find out, and also contact this prominent family. It was not for him, the president, to give him an answer. The leader of the opposition was persistent He insisted to a point where the presiding officer of parliament was compelled to ask him to leave the chamber. As he left the chamber, he was followed by the members of the opposition. Of course, something which the media loved very much, and this was reported widely, not only in South Africa, but internationally. The reason why this is a very strange event is that if anyone understands African politics, or even development politics for that matter, the issue of a prominent wife, a prominent friend, or even a prominent girlfriend influencing presidents to nominate this or that person to cabinet is nothing new. Often this is loose talk and boastful talk that had no meaning. So it was strange to have this matter discussed in parliament. Secondly, those who also follow closely South African politics said that even though it is true that there are divisions of view within the National Economic Committee of the ANC, President Zuma's position is so strong at the moment that it is very unlikely that he would be treated the way President Mbeki was treated when he was asked to vacate his post. But there is also another point which should be pointed out. There is a pattern emerging not only in Africa but in some developing countries where a coalition between the media and the opposition tries to make a government ungovernable. And they have succeeded in the case of Venezuela. They are trying to do the same thing now in Brazil. And this is perhaps what is driving this issue in South Africa. And this is something which the Africans should not allow to happen. If you have a situation where a prominent business family is boasting of its power to influence appointment, this should be handled in a different manner rather than in parliament. Therefore, the media and the opposition should understand that this matter of handling the issue is not worthy of them. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impoga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the sun never sets without fresh news. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
All across Ukraine, people are standing up and sacrificing for universal values such as sovereignty, territorial integrity, human rights, dignity, clean and accountable government, and justice for all. The United States, said U.S. Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland, has a profound national interest in Ukraine's success. Today, Ukraine's European future is put at risk as much by enemies within as by external forces such as Russia. Ukraine's oligarchs and kleptocrats, who controlled Ukraine for decades, know their business model will be broken if Maidan reformers succeed in 2016. They are fighting back with a vengeance, said Assistant Secretary Nuland, using all levers of the old system, their control of the media, state-owned enterprises, Rada deputies, the courts, and the political machinery, while holding old loyalties and threats over the heads of decision-makers to block change. It is critical for Ukraine's leaders to set aside their differences and put their people and country first. All those who call themselves reformers must rebuild consensus behind a leadership team and an International Monetary Fund and European Union compliant program of aggressive measures to clean up corruption, restore justice, and liberalize the economy. The 2016 U.S. assistance program for Ukraine is designed to take on these challenges. Specifically, it is helping Ukraine clean up its energy sector by demonopolizing its gas market, supporting the appointment of a new prosecutor general who is committed to prosecuting corruption and asset recovery cases, and improving the business climate by streamlining the bureaucracy and moving ahead with privatization. In addition, Ukraine's judicial independence must be strengthened. Key services must be improved, including healthcare, education, and transportation. And finally, Ukraine's Ministry of Defense needs to be modernized. With strong, unified leadership in Kyiv, 2016 can and should be a turning point year for Ukraine's sovereignty and European future. As Ukraine's leaders recommit to drive the country forward, the United States will be there to support them. As Assistant Secretary Nuland said, "We must be no less rigorous than the Ukrainian people themselves in demanding Kyiv's leaders take their responsibility now to deliver a truly clean, strong, and just Ukraine while they still have the chance."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.